bloody hand of Hiram the Black, of House Hor, king of the isles and the rivers. Hiram's Arnborn grandsire, Harwin Hardhand, had taken the trident from Argilac's grandsire, Arik, whose own forebears had thrown down the last of the river kings centuries earlier. Harren's father had extended his domains east to Duskendale and Rossbury. Harren himself had devoted most of his long reign, close on 40 years, to building a gigantic castle beside the God's Eye. But with Harren Hall at last nearing completion, the Arnborn were soon free to seek fresh conquests. No king in Westeros was more feared than Black Harren, whose cruelty had become legendary all through the Seven Kingdoms. And no king in Westeros felt more threatened than Argilac the Storm King, last of the Durrandon, an aging warrior whose only heir was his maiden daughter. Thus it was that King Argilac reached out to the Targaryens on Dragonstone, offering Lord Aegon his daughter in marriage, with all the lands east of the God's Eye, from the Trident to the Blackwater Rush, as her dowry. Aegon Targaryen spurned the Storm King's proposal. He had 2 wives, he pointed out. He did not need a third. And the Dowerlands being offered had belonged to Harrenhal for more than a generation. They were not Argilac's to give. Plainly, the aging Storm King meant to establish the Targaryens along the Blackwater as a buffer between his own lands and those of Harren the Black. The Lord of Dragonstone counted with an offer of his own. He would take the Dowerlands being offered if Argilac would also cede Massey's Hook and the woods and plains from the Blackwater south to the river Wenwater and the headwaters of the Mander. The pact would be sealed by the marriage of King Argilac's daughter to Orys Baratheon, Lord Aegon's childhood friend and champion. These terms Argilac the Arrogant rejected angrily. Orys Baratheon was a base-born half-brother to Lord Aegon, it was whispered, and the Storm King would not dishonour his daughter by giving her hand to a bastard. The very suggestion enraged him. Argilac had the hands of Aegon's envoy cut off and returned to him in a box. "These are the only hands your bastard shall have of me," he wrote. Aegon made no reply. Instead, he summoned his friends, bannermen, and principal allies to attend him on Dragonstone. Their numbers were small. The Valyrians on Driftmark were sworn to House Targaryen, as were the Celtigars of Claw Isle. From Massey's Hook came Lord Bar Emon of Sharppoint and Lord Massey of Stonedance, both sworn to Storm's End, but with closer ties to Dragonstone. Lord Aegon and his sisters took counsel with them and visited the castle sept to pray to the Seven of Westeros as well, though he had never before been accounted a pious man. On the seventh day, a cloud of ravens burst from the towers of Dragonstone to bring Lord Aegon's word to the Seven Kingdoms of Westeros. To the Seven Kings they flew, to the citadel of Old Town, to lords both great and small. All carried the same message. From this day forth there would be but one king in Westeros. Those who bent the knee to Aegon of House Targaryen would keep their lands and titles. Those who took up arms against him would be thrown down, humbled, and destroyed. Accounts differ on how many swords set sail from Dragonstone with Aegon and his sisters. Some say 3,000, others number them only in the hundreds. This modest Targaryen host put ashore at the mouth of the Blackwater Rush, on the northern bank, where 3 wooded hills rose above a small fishing village. In the days of the Hundred Kingdoms, many petty kings had claimed dominion over the river mouth. Amongst them, the Darklyn Kings of Duskendale, the masses of Stone Dance, and the river kings of old, be they muds, fishers, brackens, blackwoods, or hooks. Towers and forts had crowned the three hills at various times, only to be thrown down in one war or another. Now only broken stones and overgrown ruins were made to welcome the Targaryens. Though claimed by both Storm's End and Harrenhal, the river mouth was undefended, and the closest castles were held by lesser lords of no great power or military prowess, and lords, moreover, who had little reason to love their nominal overlord, Harren the Black. Aegon Targaryen quickly threw up a lug and earth palisade around the highest of the three hills and dispatched his sisters to secure the submission of the nearest castles. Rosby yielded to Rhaenys and golden-eyed Meraxes without a fight. At Stokeworth, a few crossbowmen loosed bolts at Visenya until Vhagar's flames set the roofs of the castle keep ablaze. Then they too submitted. The conqueror's first true test came from Lord Darklyn of Duskendale and Lord Mouton of Maidenpool, who joined their power and marched south with 3,000 men to drive the invaders back into the sea. Aegon sent Ori's Baratheon out to attack them on the march, whilst he descended on them from above with the Black Dread. Both lords were slain in the one-sided battle that followed. Darklyn's son and Mouton's brother thereafter yielded up their castles and swore their swords to House Targaryen. At that time, Duskendale was the principal Westerosi port on the narrow sea and had grown fat and wealthy from the trade that passed through its harbour. Visenya Targaryen did not allow the town to be sacked, but she did not hesitate to claim its riches, greatly swelling the coffers of her conquerors. This perhaps would be an apt place to discuss the differing characters of Aegon Targaryen and his sisters and queens. Visenya, eldest of the three siblings, was as much a warrior as Aegon himself, as comfortable in ringmail as in silk. She carried the Valyrian longsword Dark Sister and was skilled in its use, having trained beside her brother since childhood. Though possessed of the silver-gold hair and purple eyes of Valyria, hers was a harsh, austere beauty. Even those who loved her best found Visenya stern, serious, unforgiving, and some said that she played with poisons and dabbled in dark sorceries. Rhaenys, youngest of the three Targaryens, was all her sister was not, playful, curious, impulsive, given to flights of fancy. No true warrior, Rhaenys loved music, dancing, and poetry, and supported many a singer, mummer, and puppeteer. Yet it was said that Rhaenys spent more time on Dragonback than her brother and sister combined, for above all things she loved to fly. She once was heard to say that before she died, she meant to fly Meraxes across the sunset sea to see what lay upon its western shores. Whilst no one ever questioned Visenya's fidelity to her brother husband, Rhaenys surrounded herself with comely young men, and, it was whispered, even entertained some in her bedchambers on the nights when Aegon was with her elder sister. Yet despite these rumours, observers at court could not fail to note that the king spent 10 nights with Rhaenys for every night with Visenya. Aegon Targaryen himself, strangely, was as much an enigma to his contemporaries as to us. Armed with a Valyrian steel blade, Blackfyre, he was counted amongst the greatest warriors of his age. Yet he took no pleasure in feats of arms, and never rode in tourney or melee. His mount was Balerion the Black Dread, but he flew only to battle, or to travel swiftly across land and sea. His commanding presence drew men to his banners, yet he had no close friends, save Oris Baratheon, the companion of his youth. Women were drawn to him, but Aegon remained ever faithful to his sisters. As king, he put great trust in his small council and his sisters, leaving much of the day-to-day governance of the realm to them, yet did not hesitate to take command when he found it necessary. Though he dealt harshly with rebels and traitors, he was open-handed with former foes who bent the knee. This he showed for the first time at the Aegon Fort, the crude wood and earth castle he had raised atop what was henceforth and forever known as Aegon's High Hill. Having taken a dozen castles and secured the mouth of the Blackwater Rush on both sides of the river, he commanded the lords he had defeated to attend him. There they laid their swords at his feet, and Aegon raised them up and confirmed them in their lands and titles. To his older supporters he gave new honours. Daemon Velaryon, Lord of the Tides, was made master of ships in command of the royal fleet. Tristan Massey, Lord of Stonedance, was named Master of Laws. Crispian Celtigar, Master of Coin. And Oris Baratheon he proclaimed to be my shield, my stalwart, my strong right hand. Thus Baratheon is reckoned by the maesters the first king's hand. Heraldic banners had long been a tradition amongst the lords of Westeros, but such had never been used by the dragon lords of old Valyria. When Aegon's knights unfurled his great silken battle standard, with a red, three-headed dragon breathing fire upon a black field, the lords took it for a sign that he was now truly one of them, a worthy high king for Westeros. When Queen Visenya placed a Valyrian steel circlet studded with rubies on her brother's head, and Queen Rhaenys hailed him as Aegon, first of his name, king of all Westeros and shield of his people, the dragons roared, and the lords and knights sent up a cheer. But the small folk, the fishermen, and field hands, and goodwives, shouted loudest of all. The seven kings that Aegon the Dragon meant to uncrown were not cheering, however. In Harrenhal and Storm's End, Heron the Black and Argilac the Arrogant had already called their banners. In the west, King Mern of the Reach rode the ocean road north to Casterly Rock to meet with King Loren of House Lannister. The Princess of Dawn dispatched a raven to Dragonstone, offering to join Aegon against Argilac the Storm King, but as an equal, an ally, not a subject. Another offer of alliance came from the boy king of the Eyrie, Ronald Aeron, whose mother asked for all the lands east of the Green Fork of the Trident for the Vale support against Black Heron. Even in the north, King Torrhen Stark of Winterfell sat with his lords, bannermen, and councillors late into the night, discussing what was to be done about this would-be conqueror. The whole realm waited anxiously to see where Aegon would move next. Within days of his coronation, Aegon's armies were on the march again. The greater part of his host crossed the Blackwater Rush, making south for Storm's End under the command of Oris Baratheon. Queen Rhaenys accompanied him, astride Meraxes of the Golden Eyes and Silver Scales. The Targaryen fleet, under Daemon Velaryon, left Blackwater Bay and turned north for Gulltown and the Vale. With them went Queen Visenya and Vhagar. The king himself marched northeast to the God's Eye and Harrenhal, the gargantuan fortress that was the pride and obsession of King Haran the Black, and which he had completed and occupied on the very day Aegon landed in what would one day become King's Landing. All three of the Targaryen thrusts faced fierce opposition. Lords Errol, Fell, and Buckler, Bannermen to Storm's End, surprised the advance elements of Orys Baratheon's host as they were crossing the Windwater, cutting down more than 1,000 men before fading back into the trees. A hastily assembled Aeryn fleet, augmented by 12 Bravossi warships, met and defeated the Targaryen fleet in the waters off Gulltown. Amongst the dead was Aegon's admiral, Daemon Velaryon. Aegon himself was attacked on the south shore of the God's Eye, not once but twice. The Battle of the Reeds was a Targaryen victory, but they suffered heavy losses at the Wailing Willows when two of King Haran's sons crossed the lake in longboats with muffled oars and fell upon their rear. Such defeats proved no more than setbacks, however, and in the end, Aegon's enemies had no answer for his dragons. The men of the Vale sank a third of the Targaryen ships and captured near as many. But when Queen Visenya descended upon them from the sky, their own ships burned. Lords Errol, Fell, and Buckler hid in their familiar forests until Queen Rhaenys unleashed Meraxes and a wall of fire swept through the woods, turning the trees to torches, and the victors at the Wailing Willows, returning across the lake to Harrenhal, were ill-prepared when Beleriand fell upon them out of the morning sky. Haran's longboats burned. So did Haran's sons. Aegon's foes also found themselves plagued by other enemies. As Argilac the Arrogant gathered his swords at Storm's End, pirates from the Stepstones descended on the shores of Cape Wrath to take advantage of their absence, and Dornish raiding parties came boiling out of the Red Mountains to sweep across the marches. In the Vale, young King Ronnel had to contend with a rebellion on the Three Sisters, when the Sistermen renounced all allegiance to the Eyrie and proclaimed Lady Marla Sunderland their queen. Yet these were but minor vexations compared to what befell Haran the Black. Though House Hor had ruled the Riverlands for 3 generations, the men of the Trident had no love for their iron-born overlords. Haran the Black had driven thousands to their deaths in the building of his great castle of Harrenhal, plundering the Riverlands for materials and beggaring lords and small folk alike with his appetite for gold. So now the Riverlands rose against him, led by Lord Edmund Tully of Riverrun. Summoned to the defense of Harrenhal, Tully declared for House Targaryen instead, raised the dragon banner over his castle, and rode forth with his knights and archers to join his strength to Aegon's. His defiance gave heart to the other river lords. One by one, the lords of the Trident renounced Haran and declared for Aegon the Dragon. Blackwoods, Malisters, Vances, Brackens, Pipers, Freys, Strongs, summoning their levies, they descended on Harrenhal. Suddenly outnumbered, King Haran the Black took refuge in his supposedly impregnable stronghold, the largest castle ever raised in Westeros. Harrenhal boasted 5 gargantuan towers, an inexhaustible source of fresh water, huge subterranean vaults well stocked with provisions, and massive walls of black stone higher than any ladder and too thick to be broken by any ram or shattered by a trebuchet. Haran barred his gates and settled down with his remaining sons and supporters to withstand a siege. Aegon of Dragonstone was of a different mind. Once he had joined his power with that of Edmund Tully and the other river lords to ring the castle, he sent a maester to the gates under a peace banner to parley. Harren emerged to meet him, an old man and grey, yet still fierce in his black armour. Each king had his banner-bearer and his maester in attendance, so the words that they exchanged are still remembered. "Yield now," Aegon began, "and you may remain as Lord of the Iron Islands. Yield now, and your sons will live to rule after you. I have 8,000 men outside your walls." "What is outside my walls is of no concern to me," said Harren. "Those walls are strong and thick, but not so high as to keep out dragons. Dragons fly." "I built in stone," said Harren. "Stone does not burn." To which Aegon said, "When the sun sets, your line shall end." It is said that Harren spat at that and returned to his castle. Once inside, he sent every man of his to the parapets, armed with spears and bows and crossbows, promising lands and riches to whichever of them could bring the dragon down. "Had I a daughter, the dragon slayer could claim her hand as well," Harren the Black proclaimed. "Instead, I will give him one of Tully's daughters, or all three if he likes, or he may pick one of Blackwood's whelps or strongs, or any girl born of these traitors of the Trident, these lords of yellow mud." Then Harren the Black retired to his tower, surrounded by his household guard, to sup with his remaining sons. As the last light of the sun faded, Black Heron's men stared into the gathering darkness, clutching their spears and crossbows. When no dragon appeared, some may have thought that Aegon's threats had been hollow. But Aegon Targaryen took Beleriand up high, through the clouds, up and up until the dragon was no bigger than a fly upon the moon. Only then did he descend, well inside the castle walls. On wings as black as pitch, Beleriand plunged through the night, and when the great towers of Harrenhal appeared beneath him, the dragon roared his fury and bathed them in black fire, shot through with swirls of red. "Stone does not burn," Harren had boasted. But his castle was not made of stone alone. Wood and wool, hemp and straw, bread and salted beef and grain, all took fire, nor were Harren's iron men made of stone. Smoking, screaming, shrouded in flames, they ran across the yards and tumbled from the wall walks to die upon the ground below. And even stone will crack and melt, if a fire is hot enough. The river lords outside the castle walls said later that the towers of Harrenhal glowed red against the night, like five great candles, and like candles they began to twist and melt, as runnels of molten stone ran down their sides. Harren and his last sons died in the fires that engulfed his monstrous fortress that night. House Hor died with him, and so too did the Iron Islands hold on the riverlands. The next day, outside the smoking ruins of Harrenhal, King Aegon accepted an oath of fealty from Edmund Tully, Lord of Riverrun, and named him Lord Paramount of the Trident. The other river lords did homage as well, to Aegon as king and to Edmund Tully as their liege lord. When the ashes are cooled enough to allow men to enter the castle safely, the swords of the fallen, many shattered or melted or twisted into ribbons of steel by dragonfire, were gathered up and sent back to the Aegon fort in wagons. South and east, the Storm King's bannermen proved considerably more loyal than King Harren's. Argilac the Arrogant gathered a great host about him at Storm's End. The seat of the Durandons was a mighty fastness, its great curtain wall even thicker than the walls of Harrenhal. It too was thought to be impregnable to assault. Word of King Harren's end soon reached the ears of his old enemy, King Argilac, however. Lords Fell and Buckler, falling back before the approaching host, Lord Errol had been killed, had sent him word of Queen Rhaenys and her dragon. The old warrior king roared that he did not intend to die as Harren had, cooked inside his own castle like a suckling pig with an apple in his mouth. No stranger to battle, he would decide his own fate, sword in hand. So Argilac the Arrogant rode forth from Storm's End one last time to meet his foes in the open field. The Storm King's approach was no surprise to Aurus Baratheon and his men. Queen Rhaenys, flying Meraxes, had witnessed Argilac's departure from Storm's End and was able to give the Hand a full accounting of the enemy's numbers and dispositions. Aurus took up a strong position on the hills south of Bronzegate and dug in there on the high ground to await the coming of the Stormlanders. As the armies came together, the Stormlands proved true to their name. A steady rain began to fall that morning, and by midday had turned into a howling gale. King Argilac's lord's bannermen urged him to delay his attack until the next day, in hopes the rain would pass. But the Storm King outnumbered the conquerors almost 2-1, and had almost 4 times as many knights and heavy horse. The sight of the Targaryen banners flapping sudden above his own hills enraged him, and the battle-seasoned old warrior did not fail to note that the rain was blowing from the south into the faces of the Targaryen men on their hills. So Argilac the Arrogant gave the command to attack, and the battle known to history as the Last Storm began. The fighting lasted well into the night, a bloody business, and far less one-sided than Aegon's conquest of Harrenhal. Thrice Argilac the Arrogant led his knights against the Baratheon positions, but the slopes were steep, and the rain had turned the ground soft and muddy, so the war horses struggled and foundered, and the chargers lost all cohesion and momentum. The Stormlanders fared better when they sent their spearmen up the hills on foot. Blinded by the rain, the invaders did not see them climbing until it was too late, and the wet bowstrings of the archers made their bows useless. One hill fell, then another, and the third and final charge of the Storm King and his knights broke through the Baratheon center, only to come upon Queen Rhaenys and Meraxes. Even on the ground, the dragon proved formidable. Dickon Morrigan and the Bastard of Blackhaven, commanding the vanguard, were engulfed in dragonflame, along with the knights of King Argilac's personal guard. The war horses panicked and fled in terror, crashing into riders behind them and turning the charge into chaos. The Storm King himself was thrown from his saddle. Yet still Argilac continued to battle. When Aurus Baratheon came down the muddy hill with his own men, he found the old king holding off half a dozen men with as many corpses at his feet. "Stand aside," Baratheon commanded. He dismounted, so as to meet the king on equal footing, and offered the Storm King one last chance to yield. Argilac cursed him instead, and so they fought. The old warrior king, with his streaming white hair and Aegon's fierce, black-bearded hand. Each man took a wound from the other, it was said. But in the end, the last of the Dorridon got his wish and died with a sword in his hand and a curse on his lips. The death of their king took all heart out of the Stormlanders, and as the word spread that Argilac had fallen, his lords and knights threw down their swords and fled. For a few days it was feared that Storm's End might suffer the same fate as Harrenhal, for Argilac's daughter, Argella, barred her gates at the approach of Aurus Baratheon and the Targaryen host, and declared herself the Storm Queen. Rather than bend the knee, the defenders of Storm's End would die to the last man, she promised, when Queen Rhaenys flew Meraxes into the castle to parley. "You may take my castle, but you will win only bones and blood and ashes," she announced. But the soldiers of the garrison proved less eager to die. That night they raised a peace banner, threw open the castle gate, and delivered Lady Argella, gagged, chained, and naked, to the camp of Orys Baratheon. It is said that Baratheon unchained her with his own hands, wrapped his cloak around her, poured her wine, and spoke to her gently, telling her of her father's courage and the manner of his death. And afterward, to honour the fallen king, he took the arms and words of the Durrandon for his own. The crown stag became his sigil. Storm's End became his seat, and Lady Argella his wife. With both the Riverlands and Stormlands now under the control of Aegon the Dragon and his allies, the remaining kings of Westeros saw plainly that their own turns were coming. At Winterfell, King Tarrin called his banners. Given the vast distances in the north, he knew that assembling an army would take time. Queen Shara of the Vale, regent for her son Ronnel, took refuge in the Eyrie, looked to her defences, and sent an army to the Bloody Gate, gateway to the Vale of Erin. In her youth, Queen Shara had been lauded as the Flower of the Mountain, the fairest maid in all the Seven Kingdoms. Perhaps hoping to sway Aegon with her beauty, she sent him a portrait of herself and offered herself to him in marriage, provided he named her son Ronnel as his heir. Though the portrait did finally reach him, it is not known whether Aegon Targaryen ever replied to her proposal. He had two queens already, and Shara Aaron was by then a faded flower, 10 years his elder. Meanwhile, the two great western kings had made common cause and assembled their own armies, intent on putting an end to Aegon for good and all. From Highgarden marched Mern the Ninth of House Gardener, King of the Reach, with a mighty host. Beneath the walls of Castle Goldengrove, seat of House Rowan, he met Lauren the First Lannister, King of the Rock, leading his own host down from the Westerlands. Together the two kings commanded the mightiest host ever seen in Westeros, an army 55,000 strong, including some 600 lords, great and small, and more than 5,000 mounted knights. "Our iron fist," boasted King Mern. His four sons rode beside him, and both of his young grandsons attended him as squires. The two kings did not linger long at Golden Grove. A host of such size must remain on the march, lest it eat the surrounding countryside bare. The allies set out at once, marching north by northeast through tall grasses and golden fields of wheat. Advised of their coming in his camp beside the God's Eye, Aegon gathered his own strength and advanced to meet these new foes. He commanded only a fifth as many men as the two kings, and much of his strength was made up of men sworn to the Riverlords, whose loyalty to House Targaryen was of recent vintage and untested. With the smaller host, however, Aegon was able to move much more quickly than his foes. At the town of Stony Sept, both his queens joined him with their dragons, Rhaenys from Storm's End and Visenya from Crackclaw Point, where she had accepted many fervent pledges of fealty from the local lords. Together, the three Targaryens watched from the sky as Aegon's army crossed the headwaters of the Blackwater Rush and raced south. The two armies came together amongst the wide open plains south of the Blackwater, near to where the Gold Road would run one day. The two kings rejoiced when their scouts returned to them to report Targaryen numbers and dispositions. They had 5 men for every one of Aegon's, it seemed, and the disparity in lords and knights was even greater, and the land was wide and open, all grass and wheat as far as the eye could see, ideal for heavy horse. Aegon Targaryen did not command the high ground, as Orys Baratheon had at the last storm. The ground was firm, not muddy. Nor were they troubled by rain. The day was cloudless, though windy. There had been no rain for more than a fortnight. King Mern had brought half again as many men to the battle as King Loren, and so demanded the honour of commanding the centre. His son and heir, Edmund, was given the vanguard. King Loren and his knights formed the right, Lord Oakheart the left. With no natural barriers to anchor the Targaryen line, the two kings meant to sweep around Aegon on both flanks, then take him in the rear, whilst their iron fist, a great wedge of armoured knights and high lords, smashed through Aegon's centre. Aegon Targaryen drew his own men up in a rough crescent, bristling with spears and pikes, with archers and crossbowmen just behind, and light cavalry on either flank. He gave command of his host to John Mouton, Lord of Maidenpool, one of the first foes to come over to his cause. The king himself intended to do his fighting from the sky, beside his queens. Aegon had noted the absence of rain as well. The grass and wheat that surrounded the armies was tall and ripe for harvest, and very dry. The Targaryens waited until the two kings sounded their trumpets and started forward beneath a sea of banners. King Mern himself led the charge against the centre on his golden stallion, his son Gawain beside him, with his banner, a great green hand upon a field of white. Roaring and screaming, urged on by horns and drums, the gardeners and Lannisters charged through a storm of arrows down onto their foes, sweeping aside the Targaryen spearmen, shattering their ranks. But by then Aegon and his sisters were in the air. Aegon flew above the ranks of his foes upon Beleriand. Through a storm of spears and stones and arrows, swooping down repeatedly to bathe his foes in flame. Rhaenys and Visenya set fires upwind of the enemy and behind them. The dry grasses and stands of wheat went up at once. The wind fanned the flames and blew the smoke into the faces of the advancing ranks of the two kings. The scent of fire sent their mounts into panic, and as the smoke thickened, horse and rider alike were blinded. Their ranks began to break as walls of fire rose on every side of them. Lord Mouton's men, safely upwind of the conflagration, waited with their bows and spears and made short work of the burned and burning men who came staggering from the inferno. The Field of Fire, the battle was named afterward. More than 4,000 men died in the flames. Another 1,000 perished from sword and spears and arrows. Tens of thousands suffered burns, some so bad that they remained scarred for life. King Mern the Ninth was among the dead, together with his sons, grandsons, brothers, cousins, and other kin. One nephew survived for 3 days. When he died of his burns, House Gardener died with him. King Loren of the Rock lived, riding through a wall of flame and smoke to safety when he saw the battle lost. The Targaryens lost fewer than 100 men. Queen Visenya took an arrow in one shoulder but soon recovered. As his dragons gorged themselves on the dead, Aegon commanded that the swords of the slain be gathered up and sent downriver. Loren Lannister was captured the next day. The King of the Rock laid his sword and crown at Aegon's feet, bent the knee, and did him homage. And Aegon, true to his promises, lifted his beaten foe back to his feet and confirmed him in his lands and lordship, naming him Lord of Casterly Rock and Warden of the West. Lord Loren's bannermen followed his example, and so too did many lords of the Reach, those who had survived the dragon fire. Yet the conquest of the West remained incomplete, so King Aegon parted from his sisters and marched at once for Highgarden, hoping to secure its surrender before some other claimant could seize it for his own. He found the castle in the hands of its steward, Harlan Tyrell, whose forebears had served the Gardeners for centuries. Tyrell yielded up the keys to the castle without a fight and pledged his support to the conquering king. In reward, Aegon granted him Highgarden and all its domains, naming him Warden of the South and Lord Paramount of the Mander, and giving him dominion over all House Gardener's former vassals. It was King Aegon's intent to continue his march south and enforce the submission of Oldtown, the Arbor, and Dawn. But whilst at Highgarden, the word of a new challenge came to his ears. Torrhen Stark, king in the north, had crossed the Neck and entered the Riverlands, leading an army of savage Northmen 30,000 strong. Aegon at once started north to meet him, racing ahead of his army on the wings of Beleriand the Black Dread. He sent word to his two queens as well, and to all the lords and knights who had bent the knee to him after Harrenhal and the Field of Fire. When Torrhen Stark reached the banks of the Trident, he found a host half again the size of his own, awaiting him south of the river. River lords, westermen, stormlanders, men of the Reach, all had come. And above their camp, Beleriand, Meraxes, and Vhagar prowled the sky in ever-widening circles. Torrhen's scouts had seen the ruins of Harrenhal, where slow red fires still burned beneath the rubble. The king in the north had heard many accounts of the Field of Fire as well. He knew that the same fate might await him if he tried to force a crossing of the river. Some of his lord's bannermen urged him to attack all the same, insisting that northern valour would carry the day. Others urged him to fall back to Moat Cailin and make his stand there on northern soil. The king's bastard brother, Brandon Snow, offered to cross the Trident alone, under cover of darkness, to slay the dragons whilst they slept. King Torrhen did send Brandon Snow across the Trident, but he crossed with three maesters by his side, not to kill, but to treat. All through the night, messages went back and forth. The next morning, Torrhen Stark himself crossed the Trident. There upon the south bank of the Trident, he knelt, laid the ancient crown of the Kings of Winter at Aegon's feet, and swore to be his man. He rose as Lord of Winterfell and Warden of the North, a king no more. From that day to this day, Torrhen Stark is remembered as the king who knelt. But no Northman left his burned bones beside the Trident, and the swords Aegon collected from Lord Stark and his vassals were not twisted or melted or bent. Now once again Aegon Targaryen and his queens parted company. Aegon turned south once more, marching toward Oldtown, whilst his two sisters mounted their dragons, Visenya for a second attempt at the Vale of Erin, and Rhaenys for Sunspear and the Deserts of Dawn. Shara Erin had strengthened the defences of Gulltown, moved a strong host to the Bloody Gate, and tripled the size of the garrisons in stone, snow, and sky, the way castles that guarded the approach to the Eyrie. All these defences proved useless against Visenya Targaryen, who rode Vhagar's leathery wings above them all, and landed in the Eyrie's inner courtyard. When the regent of the Vale rushed out to confront her, with a dozen guards at her back, she found Visenya with Ronwell Aeron seated on her knee, staring at the dragon, wonderstruck. "Mother, can I go flying with the lady?" the boy king asked. No threats were spoken, no angry words exchanged. The two queens smiled at one another and exchanged courtesies instead. Then Lady Shearer sent for the three crowns, her own regent's coronet and her son's small crown, and the falcon crown of mountain and vale that the Erin kings had worn for 1,000 years, and surrendered them to Queen Visenya, along with the swords of her garrison. And it was said afterward that the little king flew thrice about the summit of the giant's lance, and landed to find himself a little lord. Thus did Visenya Targaryen bring the Vale of Arryn into her brother's realm. Rhaenys Targaryen had no such easy conquest. A host of Dornish spearmen guarded the Prince's Pass, the gateway through the Red Mountains, but Rhaenys did not engage them. She flew above the pass, above the red sands and the white, and descended upon Vaith to demand its submission, only to find the castle empty and abandoned. In the tarn beneath its walls, only women and children and old men remained. When asked where their lords had gone, they would only say, "Away." Rhaenys followed the river downstream to God's Grace, seat of House Salarion, but it too was deserted. On she flew. Where the green blood met the sea, Rhaenys came upon the Planky Town, where hundreds of pole boats, fishing skiffs, barges, houseboats and hulks sat baking in the sun, joined together with ropes and chains and planks to make a floating city. Yet only a few old women and small children appeared to peer up at her as Meraxes circled overhead. Finally, the Queen's flight took her to Sunspear, the ancient seat of Haas Martell, where she found the Princess of Dorne waiting in her abandoned castle. Mirya Martell was 80 years of age, the maesters tell us, and had ruled the Dornishmen for 60 of those years. She was very fat, blind, and almost bald, her skin sallow and sagging. Argilac the Arrogant had named her the Yellow Toad of Dawn, but neither age nor blindness had dulled her wits. "I will not fight you," Princess Mirya told Rhaenys, "nor will I kneel to you. Dawn has no king. Tell your brother that." "I shall," Rhaenys replied. "But we will come again, Princess, and the next time we shall come with fire and blood." "Your words," said Princess Mirya. "Ours are unbowed, unbent, unbroken. You may burn us, my lady, but you will not bend us, break us, or make us bow. This is Dawn. You are not wanted here. Return at your peril." Thus Queen and Princess parted, and Dawn remained unconquered. To the west, Aegon Targaryen met a warmer welcome. The greatest city in all of Westeros, Old Town, was ringed about with massive walls, and ruled by the High Towers of High Tower, the oldest, richest, and most powerful of the noble houses of the Reach. Old Town was also the center of the Faith. There dwelt the High Septon, father of the faithful, the voice of the new gods on earth, who commanded the obedience of millions of the devout throughout the realms, save in the north, where the old gods still held sway. And the blades of the faith militant, the fighting orders the small folk called the Stars and Swords. Yet when Aegon Targaryen and his host approached Old Town, they found the city gates open, and Lord Hightower waiting to make his submission. As it happened, when word of Aegon's landing first reached Old Town, the High Septon had locked himself within the Starry Sept for 7 days and 7 nights, seeking after the guidance of the gods. He took no nourishment, but bread and water, it is said, and spent all his waking hours in prayer, moving from one altar to the next. And on the 7th day, the crone had lifted her golden lamp to show him the path ahead. If Old Town took up arms against Aegon the Dragon, his High Holiness saw, the city would surely burn, and the High Tower and the Citadel and the Starry Sept would be cast down and destroyed. Manfred Hightower, Lord of Old Town, was a cautious lord and godly. One of his younger sons served with the Warrior's Sons, and another had only recently taken vows as a septon. When the High Septon told him of the vision vouchsafed him by the crone, Lord Hightower determined that he would not oppose the conqueror by force of arms. Thus it was that no men from Old Town burned on the field of fire. though the high towers were bannermen to the gardeners of High Garden. And thus it was that Lord Manford rode forth to greet Aegon the Dragon as he approached, and to offer up his sword, his city, and his oath. Some say that Lord Hightower also offered up the hand of his youngest daughter, which Aegon declined politely, lest it offend his two queens. 3 days later, in the Starry Sept, His High Holiness himself anointed Aegon with the 7 oils, placed a crown upon his head, and proclaimed him Aegon of House Targaryen, the first of his name, King of the Andals, the Rhoynar, and the First Men, Lord of the 7 kingdoms, and Protector of the Realm. 7 kingdoms was the style used, though Dorne had not submitted, nor would it for more than a century to come. Only a handful of lords had been present for Aegon's first coronation at the mouth of the Blackwater, but hundreds were on hand to witness his second, and tens of thousands cheered him afterward in the streets of Old Town as he rode through the city on Balerion's back. Amongst those at Aegon's second coronation were the maesters and archmaesters of the citadel. Perhaps for that reason it was this coronation rather than the Aegonfort crowning or the day of Aegon's landing that became fixed as the start of Aegon's reign. Thus were the 7 kingdoms of Westeros hammered into one great realm by the will of Aegon the Conqueror and his sisters. Many thought that King Aegon would make Old Town his royal seat after the wars were done, whilst others thought he would rule from Dragonstone, the ancient island citadel of House Targaryen. The king surprised them all by proclaiming his intent to make his court in the new town already rising beneath the 3 hills at the mouth of the Blackwater Rush, at the place where he and his sisters had first set foot on the soil of Westeros. King's Landing, the new town was called. From there Aegon the Dragon ruled his realm, holding court from a great metal seat made from the melted, twisted, beaten, and broken blades of all his fallen foes. A perilous seat that would soon be known through all the world as the Iron Throne of Westeros. The Targaryen Kings. Aegon the First. King Aegon the First of his name might have conquered the 7 kingdoms by the age of 27, but now he faced the formidable challenge of ruling his newly forged realm. The 7 warring kingdoms had rarely been at peace within their own borders, let alone without them, and uniting them under one rule required a truly remarkable man. So it was fortunate for the realm that Aegon was such a man with vision and determination aplenty, and though his vision of a united Westeros proved harder to realize than Aegon might have believed, not to mention far costlier, it was a vision that shaped the course of history for hundreds of years to come. It was Aegon who saw a great royal city to rival and surpass Lannisport and Old Town spring up around his crude Aegonfort. And while King's Landing might have been a crowded, muddy, and stinking place at his outset, it was always full of activity. A makeshift sept, constructed out of the hulk of a cog on the Blackwater, served the common people, and soon a much grander sept was raised on Visenya's Hill with money sent by the High Septon. This would be later joined by the Sept of Remembrance on the Hill of Rhaenys as a memorial to the Queen. Where once only fishing boats were seen, now cogs and galleys from Old Town, Lannisport, the Free Cities, and even the Summer Isles began to appear as the flow of trade shifted from Duskendale and Maidenpool to King's Landing. The Aegonfort itself grew larger, bursting past its initial palisade to encompass more of Aegon's high hill, and a new wooden keep was raised, its walls 50 feet high. It stood until 35 AC, when Aegon tore it down so that the Red Keep could be raised as a castle fit for the Targaryens and their heirs. By 10 AC, King's Landing had become a true city, and by 25 AC it had surpassed White Harbour and Gulltown to become the realm's third largest city. And yet for much of this time it was a city without walls. It may be that Aegon and his sisters thought that no one would dare assault a city that held dragons. But in 19 AC, word came of a pirate fleet sacking Tall Trees Town in the Summer Isles, carrying off thousands into slavery and a fortune in wealth. Troubled by this, and realizing that he and Visenya were not always at King's Landing, Aegon at last commanded that walls be raised. Grand Maester Gowan and the Hand, Sir Osmond Strong, were given charge of the project. Aegon decreed there should be room enough for the city to expand within those walls, and that seven great gatehouses would defend seven gates in honour of the seven. Construction began the next year, and by 26 AC it was completed.
According to the history of Archmaester Gildane, it was suggested at court that Aegon left Queen Visenya in charge of building the Red Keep, so that he would not have to endure her presence on Dragonstone. In their later years, their relationship, never a warm one to begin with, had grown even more distant.
As the city and its prosperity grew, so did that of the realm. This was in part due to the conqueror's efforts to win the respect of his vassals and that of the small folk. In this he was often aided by Queen Rhaenys, whilst she lived, for whom the small folk were of special concern. She was likewise a patron to singers and bards, something her sister, Queen Visenya, thought a waste. But those singers made songs of praise for their Targaryens and carried them throughout the realm. And if those songs also contained bold lies that made Aegon and his sister seem all the more glorious, the queen did not rue it, although the maesters might. The queen also did much to bring the realm together through the marriages she arranged between far-flung houses. Thus Rhaenys' death in Dorne in 10 AC and the wrath that followed it was felt by much of the realm, who had loved the beautiful, kind-hearted queen.
The Rule of Six, now part of the common law, was established by Rhaenys as she sat on the Iron Throne while the king was upon one of his progresses. A petition was made by the brothers of a woman who had been beaten to death by her husband after he caught her with another. He defended himself by rightly noting that it was lawful for a man to chastise an adulterous wife, which was true enough, though in Dorne matters are elsewise, so long as he used a rod no thicker than a thumb. However, he had struck her 100 times, according to the brothers, and this he did not deny. After deliberating with the maesters and septons, Rhaenys declared that, whilst the gods made women to be dutiful to their husbands and so could be lawfully beaten, only 6 blows might ever be struck, one for each of the seven, save the stranger, who was death. For this reason, she declared that 94 of the husband's blows had been unlawful, and agreed that the dead woman's brothers could match those blows upon the husband.
Yet, despite a reign covered in glory, the First Dornish War stood out as Aegon's one great defeat. The First Dornish War began boldly in 4 AC and ended in 13 AC after years of tragedy and spilled blood. Many were the calamities of that war: the death of Rhaenys, the years of the Dragon's Wrath, the murdered lords, the would-be assassins in King's Landing, and the Red Keep itself. It was a black time. But out of all the tragedy was born one glorious thing, the sworn brotherhood of the King's Guard. When Aegon and Visenya placed prices on the heads of the Dornish lords. Many were murdered, and in retaliation, the Dornish men hired their own catspaws and killers.